Today's Veterans Radio program is dedicated to the men and women who served in the military during the Korean War and whose honor, 60 years ago, we salute today.
From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Bob Gould.
And good morning, good day to all the wonderful listeners out here listening to Veterans Radio today from WDEO, part of the Ave Maria Network, right here in beautiful Ann Arbor, Michigan. And with me today is my partner and founder. We were just talking about 10 years ago. He and I shook hands and said, you know what, let's start this here radio program. How about that? That was 10 years ago, July.
That sounded like a good idea then. It's still a good
still
idea.
Still, it's a great idea. It's a great idea. I mean, well, we could have the honor of speaking to you, our listeners, 60 years after the conclusion, of course, it's still going on as far as I'm concerned, the Korean War. What an honor that is, that we have that ability, that we can do that, folks.
Well, it certainly is. It's always been an honor for us to talk to the veterans of America, both men and women, Amen. And also the civilians and everything. All the organizations that are out there that supports veterans' work and that are supporting veterans coming home, it's fantastic. Over the last 10 years, I was telling somebody earlier, it's just been such a great honor for us to meet all of you and to find out where everybody is, because, you know, it's a big country. I mean,
big country.
We're not aware of all of these little pockets of support for, you know, from all the patriotic Americans that are out there. I think it's cool. It's very cool for us.
It has, and folks, it has brought tears to all of us here on particular programs. It's brought laughter. It's brought a little sadness, a little bit of anger. It's been all the whole gamut of all the emotions.
Well, it's been a great opportunity for people to vent.
Yes. And I was talking to somebody the other day who, my dad doesn't want to talk about this at all. But I think they do. If they ever were to sit down with another vet over a beer or coffee or what, yes, you start to talk about, hey, what did you do? Well, I was in the Corps. Oh, is that right, man? And before you know it, you're long lost buddies. Whenever I see somebody with a 101st Airborne hat or patch, man, I connect with them. There were some kids the other day. I say kids. Anybody under 50 is a kid, as far as I'm concerned. And they had the camo, the digital, mm-hmm. and they had the patch on. And you know, I connected with these kids. Mm-hmm. It was so. How about you when you saw those chopper guys there at the air show?
Oh, it was like we were long-lost friends from years and years ago. And that's just the way it is. You know, our guest last week, Laura Edge, was talking about trying to get her father to talk about his experiences in World War II, and he wouldn't necessarily do it with his kids, but he did it with their grandchildren. So, and, you know, as a history project, the son went to ask Dad, so what did you do, you know, Grandpa, what did you do in World War II? And he opened up to the grandson more than he did to the kids. So, you know, try to find out what these men and women did. They're pretty truly amazing stories, and I think you'll look at your relatives in a much different light.
I know one way that you can find out what the veterans are doing is by checking your local paper. How's this for a segue?
Here we go. Lots of things going on.
Why don't you tell us about some of them, Dan?
I will. Well, the first thing I want to talk about is, those of you that have been listening to Veterans Radio for a while know that we had a guest on last November. His name is Carlos Luis Montalvan, and he wrote a book called Until Tuesday. And Tuesday is his service dog. And Tuesday really saved Carlos's life. If you read the book, it's called Until Tuesday. But Carlos is going to be in Ann Arbor this coming Thursday at the Ann Arbor Public Library on Thursday evening, August 29th, from 7 until 8:30. It's open to the public. He is there to he's going to do a presentation. Tuesday will be there. So all you dog lovers out there, I know that that's a story that you really like to get into. So, again, Thursday evening, August 29th from 7 to 8:30 at the Ann Arbor Public Library down in there.
I wonder if that'll be podcast or anything like that.
They do podcast many of those things, and they will record it, and it will be on Ann Arbor cable sometime in the future under the Ann Arbor Public Library. So Here's an opportunity for you to get to meet one of our guests. That's close and personal.
Somebody asked me the other day, why do you want to talk about things in Ann Arbor net when I live in Washington? Well, I'll tell you why, Washington State, because you probably have things that occur in your area and within your veterans group, mm-hmm. veteran community. So, 877-573-7825. Give us a call.
Tell us about them. We'll be more than happy to promote.
Or go to... Where's our, what's our big, what do we got,
veteransradio.net. Click on Contact Us, and we'll get the message, and
we'll get the message out.
Yes. We'll get the message. Number two on my list is another local story, and that's the VVA 310. VVA 310 is sponsoring their annual pig roast, and that is going to be Sunday, September 8th, from noon until 4 p.m. You can go out there. They've got tanks. They got a helicopter. They got a whole bunch of veterans who love to tell their stories to an excited audience, and I've been out there a number of times over the years talking about helicopters because we do have a static display of a Huey out there.
And they're very active in the community.
Very active. Packages. They're always a volunteer of the year at the VA hospital and so forth. Great group of guys and so forth. The last thing I want to mention is that Bob and Nina will be down in Dayton, Ohio on Saturday, September 28th for the annual Military Writers Society of America's conference.
That'll be fun.
And
great stuff.
We'll be broadcasting live from there with Dwight Zimmerman and talking to some of their winners of their books and interviewing authors all over the place.
So often we hear from our listeners, they email us, what do I buy the vet? I don't know what to buy the vet. Buy him a book. It's something they can keep forever and cherish and put down, pick up whenever you want, buy a book. And what do? We at Veterans Radio, we review these authors. When we're down in Dayton, we're going to be talking about the winners this year of various awards. So if you want to know where to look for books, get a hold of veteransradio.net. And are we going to have a special tab for all that?
We will at some point in the near future. As soon as we're so technologically challenged that sometimes
wonderful.
It takes us a while to do that. I also want to remind everybody that you can also follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and Twitter with our social media manager, Maria. She will get back to you and let you know what we're up to on Facebook and Twitter.
Maybe we should give that, facebook.com/veteransradio.
Veterans Radio.
Oh, you did. You gave all that. Okay.
I didn't give it all. I didn't give it all. But, yeah, you just go in there and it's, facebook.com/veteransradio and it'll take you to our site.
Take you right in there. Okay.
Same with Twitter.
Well, we've got quite a program today. It's going to be in celebration and honor of the 60th anniversary of the conclusion of the Korean War. And we have two wonderful guests with us. We'll be right back with our guest and the Korean War, the conclusion of 60 years later, right after this very important message.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
Mr. Sandman, bring me a dream. Make him the cutest that I've ever seen. Give him two lips like roses and clover. Then tell him that his lonesome nights.
Yeah, tell him that his lonesome nights are over. Mr. Sandman, the Cordettes. You didn't think I knew that, but I do because I listen to all that stuff all the time. And that was right at the time of the beginning of the Korean War. I'd like to read something here. Quote, it was a war in which we turned the tide against communism for the first time. Our defense of freedom laid the foundation for the march of democracy we're seeing today around the world. That was from President George Bush, 1990. So back to Korea, and that was from President Bush. I think before I introduce my first guest, I do want to, why don't I just give a little very brief bio. Our first guest is Colonel William Latham. He's a writer, historian, and course director at the United States Army Logistics University at Fort Lee, Virginia. I almost said West Virginia. Don't do that. And he flew Chinook helicopters. Dale shaking his head on that. Did you ever
fly? Very cool.
Nope, you didn't.
Never been in there.
Oh, in combat, Colonel Latham, during Operation Desert Storm. Wrote a book recently, Cold Days in Hell, American POWs in Korea. I happen to have a copy in my hand right now. I couldn't even put the darn thing down. It kept me awake last night. That and the Tigers, you know, kept me awake. Yes, absolutely. And he and his wife, family, reside in Petersburg, Virginia. His book has been published by Texas A&M University Press. And before I welcome Colonel Latham, I want to say this, because I think this kind of sums it up. Stephen Ambrose, in his book D-Day, which is a great, great, great book to have in your library, Stephen Ambrose was talking about special anecdotes of what happened on D-Day, all kinds of little things. And one of them was, which stuck in my mind, and the way I'm going to start this, is that the Americans captured 7 Koreans at Omaha Beach on D-Day. What were they doing there? Yes, and Ambrose talks, it was something like 2 hours after the battle began, they had shot their keeping charge of them, German, shot him and put their hands up. And they were sent back to Korea. So I started thinking about that. How did 7 Koreans wind up on the Normandy coast fighting for the Germans, or allegedly fighting for the Germans? Well, if you do a little back timing, and I think Colonel Latham can maybe enhance us a bit. If you do some back timing, okay, they were captured by the Germans. The Germans captured them from the Russians. The Russians captured them from
the Japanese.
The Japanese. The Japanese captured them from the Chinese. The Chinese picked them up. If that isn't a great story, Colonel Latham, welcome to Veterans Radio. What do you think about all that?
Well, I think it's very interesting, Bob. Good morning to you and Dale.
Good morning.
Thanks for having me today.
Well, you're welcome. What do you think of that? Wow, what a story.
Well, I think it reflects the fact that the Korean people during the first part of the 20th century were a dispossessed people. The Japanese occupation of Korea was harsh, and there was a large population or several populations of Korean expatriates scattered across the globe, to include in the United States. And obviously, a large contingent went to China, and many fought with the Red Army during the Second World War. Many fought with the Chinese against the Japanese during the Second World War. And many fought with the Japanese against American and British and Australian forces during World War II. So all of that makes a discussion of Korean history in the 20th century complicated.
Well, and it also points out, I like to call it the Belgium of Asia, Korea, and it points out how the tug of war and how they've really used these people. There was a time right after the Second World War, and I'm sure you can comment on this, Colonel Latham, that they were ready to give full independence to the Korean people, the Korean folks, and nope, everybody started to position themselves. There were the Chinese, there were the North Koreans, and the Russians, and the Russians were the first ones to give aid to the Koreans. And, of course, the Americans coming in saying, well, we want to fight communism, and all of a sudden now we have a divided Korea, when they were all set, ready to go, to have perhaps a more peaceful existence within the world. And after the Soviets, well, let's have Colonel Latham pick up the story from there.
Well, I would argue that the division of the Korean Peninsula after World War II was the result of miscalculations by both the Soviets and the Americans. The Soviets, for some odd reason, agreed to the American proposal to divide the zones of occupation in Korea at the 38th parallel. They certainly had enough combat power in Manchuria at that time that they could have easily marched all the way south and occupied the entire peninsula had they not agreed to joint occupation with the Americans. Frankly, the Americans didn't have much of a claim to occupy the southern half. The Soviets agreed to it, perhaps thinking there would be a quid pro quo in terms of joint occupation of Japan, which did not happen. And then the Americans grossly underestimated really both the strategic importance of Korea, which has for centuries been sort of the stepping stone from mainland China to Japan and likewise from Japan into mainland China. There is a well-worn Korean phrase for that describing Korea as a shrimp caught between two whales. The two great powers, Japan and China. And, of course, your story about the Koreans at Omaha Beach touches also on the role of the Soviets, who are a third, or the Russians, I should say now, who are a third, you know, great power deeply involved in events in northern Asia. And of course, the Russians occupy North Korea, and they build the They build and train a formidable North Korean army, and they emplace Kim Il-sung, a North Korean protege, or a Soviet protege, in power in Pyongyang. And meanwhile, south of the 38th parallel, after World War II, the American occupation is much less vigorous and reflects a certain lack of cultural awareness on what the South Korean people want and what the South Korean people value. And so, for example, General Hodge, the commander of American forces, puts those Koreans who speak English and Japanese in positions of power because they are the best educated and the most familiar with how the government bureaucracy works, not realizing that those same people are deeply resented by most South Koreans, by most Koreans south of the 38th parallel, I should say, because they are perceived as collaborators with the Japanese, in some ways comparable to the perception of the German occupation, where former Nazis seem to be the most competent bureaucrats available to keep the government running. And this is a reoccurring problem when, you know, an occupying force comes into a foreign land. Who knows how to make the government run? Well, it's the people who ran the government before the war.
Let's talk about that. Just, Colonel Latham, can we draw the parallel? If there are going to be nuclear weapons or missiles in North Korea, and that certainly would dangerously put a lot of countries in danger, including Japan. Can we draw that parallel with North Korea having weapons to attack Japan, the same thing like having the Soviets who had, or the Russians, who had missiles in Cuba and were ready to attack America? So is that a similar parallel that we can draw between the two?
Well, you know, I think we'd have to have a Japanese guest to speak to that. I don't know whether the Japanese see the North Korean threat the same way Americans saw the Soviet threat, but I do think that the development of nuclear weapons capability in North Korea certainly has Japanese attention. Particularly after the North Koreans fired a test missile over the Japanese islands a few years ago. I think that got a lot of Japanese attention. But and also, as you're probably aware, there are, you know, incidents where North Korean agents kidnapped Japanese people and took them back to North Korea, and bizarrely, those people were used as movie actors in Kim Jong-il's bizarre movie producing career. It's, you know, North Korea is just a bottomless pit of bizarre stories. But I think the general consensus today is that regardless of Japanese concerns, the great power or the superpower or near superpower with the most influence over the North Koreans is the Communist Chinese. And for better or worse right now, there is not much consensus between the Americans, the South Koreans, the Chinese, and the Japanese on what to do about North Korea, because the Chinese and the Japanese are squabbling over some minor territorial issues in I believe, the Sea of Japan, over some unoccupied islands that the Chinese and the Japanese disagree about.
So what you're saying is that this is still smoldering embers, just waiting for a strong breeze to come along.
Oh, no doubt about that.
Get it started.
I agree with, and several people have said it, but and I agree that the DMZ between North Korea and South Korea is still perhaps the most dangerous place in the world.
Folks, here is something just to let you know how geopolitics can be confusing, coincidental, and just absolutely mind-boggling. China is also a major trade partner with South Korea. So here they are backing the North Koreans, and yet they are a major trading partner with South Korea. And I like what you wrote on here, though, because they have vested interest in maintaining stability on the Korean Peninsula. Boy, that says a lot. I'd like you to comment on that, Colonel Latham.
The Chinese are, at least from what I've read, and I'm hardly an expert on Chinese policy, but from various sources I've read, the Chinese are terrified that North Korea will collapse because they fear, and I think it's a reasonable concern, that if North Korea's current regime collapses, a flood of refugees will come across the Yalu River into Manchuria, and those refugees are going to be starving. The North Korean regime has been starving its own people for at least two decades, and they will carry with them all sorts of diseases. So that's a legitimate concern. Also, quite frankly, North Korea still provides, as it did 60 years ago during the Korean War, it still provides a buffer state between mainland China and obviously very pro-Western South Korean government. And so I think the Chinese are generally far more comfortable with a friendly, if somewhat erratic, North Korean government with which they have a tentative alliance. They're more comfortable with that on their borders than they are with a pro-Western South Korean regime. So it's a buffer state, and they're worried about that implosion. But the other fear, and I think the Chinese are becoming increasingly worried about this, as the rest of us are, the rest of us being the Americans, the Japanese, the South Koreans, is the possibility of either a military takeover or some sort of desperate act of war by the North Koreans. And now that they are
doing
their weapons, the impact of that, I tell you what, Bob, nobody would win a second Korean War.
Wow. Dale, you
That's
have
true. I'm kind of later. This is Dale Thronberry. I just wanted to, in the most recent American Legion magazine, there's a great article about the Korean Peninsula and what some of the fears are as far as, you know, what people's concerns are. And one of them that I thought was really interesting was the idea that a third generation despot doesn't normally work. And, we can see that, headed in that direction. And people are afraid that the military would take over. And as you mentioned earlier, the refugees would just be flooding every direction out of North Korea because they are starving. And I, you know, we just don't understand this whole geopolitical thing about North Korea. And I was wondering if you, you know, in your book, you were talking about Korean POWs, and we've been talking about that pretty recently, last couple of months, about that there is a question of there's still possibly American POWs in North Korea. Would you like to comment on that?
I don't believe there are still American POWs in Korea. But I certainly can't say for sure. I mean, it is theoretically possible, but based on my conversations with experts in the Pentagon and my survey of the literature out there, I think mainly there are rumors. It is more possible that American POWs were held back from repatriation, but again, I haven't seen any solid proof on that. We know for a fact, however, that the North Koreans retained thousands of South Korean POWs, and to be honest, that's a story that has not been told very extensively, at least in the West, partly because there's just not much South Korean literature on it, on that situation, and even less English language scholarship on that topic. And that's really, you know, a painful story for the Korean people and an untold story of the Korean War, quite frankly.
Folks, we're talking with Colonel Bill Latham, retired, who's a writer, historian, and course director at the United States Army Logistics University at Fort Lee, Virginia. My question just before we go on a break, we have about 3 minutes before we go on break, is that right now the number of U.S. troops on the ground are shrinking. Now, does that mean that we are lessening our commitment, or do we have other defenses of which we are deploying there? You want to comment on that?
Well, as you're probably aware, Bob, the current administration has announced very publicly that they are shifting the focus of our national security efforts to the Pacific, and certainly Northeast Asia is ground zero for that area of concern, not only because of the threat of North Korea, but also because of our, you know, complicated relationship with the Chinese, a changing relationship with India, our relationship with the Japanese, our strong allies, the South Koreans and the Japanese, the size of the Pacific theater, and you know, the economic growth of the Pacific Rim. All of that makes Asia that much more important to the future of the United States. I think it's a smart shift. Probably overdue. I don't know how much of that, though, is rhetoric and how much of that is reality. I do know we've still got troops on the ground in Korea. We've still got a significant combined arms capability, air and naval forces, and we're still doing joint exercises with the Koreans. In fact, we're doing one this month, which surprisingly the North Koreans have not said much about.
Is that dangerous to do that?
Well, I think it's necessary to show to the North Koreans and others in the region that we remain committed to the security of South Korea, as we have been for, you know, over 60 years. We still honor that commitment. We still take it serious. And I will tell you that there have been times in the past, such as during the crisis over the tree cutting incident at the DMZ in 1976, and earlier on the capture of the U.S. naval ship, the Pueblo, and its crew. In both cases, there were doubts on the part of our South Korean allies about our commitment to their security because we did not respond more forcefully to what were obviously acts of North Korean aggression. Well, I would say, though, that in large part history has proven the wisdom of U.S. restraint. in those situations.
Well, why don't we hold it right there? We're going to get back with Colonel Latham and with our other special guest, Lewis Carlson, who's going to be in both Colonel Latham and Lewis Carlson. We're going to be talking about the POWs in Korea and a little bit about Colonel Latham's book. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Veterans Radio on WDEO 990 AM in Ann Arbor, WMAX 1440 AM in Saginaw, WDEO 98.5 FM in Naples, and online at AveMaria.net.
Come on to my house, in my house, I'm gonna give you candy. Come on to my house, in my house, I'm gonna give you eggs and dates and grapes and cakes. Come on to my house, my house, come on. Come on to my house, my house, come on.
Yeah, come on to my house, Miss Teresa Tessie Brewer. That's the kind of music that was going on. A lot of folks were not aware of what was going on in Korea. Just like right now. Why do you think that is, Dale? Why do you think that that's...
Well, I think there was a lot of, fatigue with the end of World War II, and now suddenly we're getting re-involved in another conflict that could potentially erupt into World War III, and I think that people were very nervous about that. I know that I had my sister, who's 10 years older than I am, one of her boyfriends was in the Marines and was sent to Korea. And, I mean, I was following it because he had a little name tag made up for me with my name spelled out in Korean. But I don't think people were, they didn't want to get involved in another worldwide conflict. I mean, they were tired. And think about what they had to do during World War II.
We already fought the Asians. Why are we fighting them again?
Absolutely. And I think that if we come back, the Korean War has never officially ended. It's open-ended, and the North Koreans have said that whatever they sign, I think Colonel Latham can back this up, they just kind of threw out the agreement, didn't they, recently? So we're not going to follow that.
They've done that several times.
I know. And it's such an attitude. It reminds me of the vertically challenged person's attitude, when you're in a room of all these tall trees and you want to kick them all in the shins, let them know you're there.
Okay, we've got the POW issue, which in 1953 captured everybody's attention because some of the American POWs decided we don't want to go back to America. We embrace communism. We embrace socialism. We want to stay here. We're having a wonderful time. They're treating us well. And what else was there on there with those guys? I think there were 23 of them, weren't there, Dale? Something? Well, we'll ask Colonel Latham. Colonel Latham's book was Cold Days in Hell, American POWs in Korea. Their publisher is Texas A&M, and I have it right in front of me. It's quite the book. In fact, we're going to once again recommend some of these books, and this one in particular, American POWs in Korea by William Clark Latham, Jr. Colonel Clark, why don't you tell us about repatriation? Here these guys go. What was it like for these guys? They got a chance to go home. What happened?
Do you mean the men who were repatriated?
Yes.
Well, I think they were thrilled. And they were lucky. Frankly, they were lucky to get out. More than half of American POWs captured during the first 6 months of the war perished during the first winter in captivity. Both the North Koreans and, to some extent, the Chinese were simply overwhelmed by the logistical demands of so many American and Allied POWs, that many men either starved or died of starvation or died of exposure or disease. And quite frankly, it was only the beginning of the ceasefire talks in July of 1951 that saved them. It was really only at that point that the Chinese, who had taken over command of the POW camps. At that point, the Chinese realized that the POWs were valuable bargaining chips. And in many ways, the war's final 2 years took so long to agree on a ceasefire primarily because of the fate of both the Western or the Western POWs in communist hands and also the fate of the communist POWs in Western hands. As you may be aware, President Truman wanted to give communist prisoners a choice of whether or not to go back to China and communist China and North Korea, because forcible repatriation of POWs back to the Soviet Union after World War II provoked a tragedy where thousands were imprisoned or executed by Stalin, and at least hundreds, if not thousands, committed suicide rather than be repatriated back to Soviet control. And so Truman and his advisors did not want a repeat of that. That put negotiators, Western negotiators, in a difficult position. The communists, of course, opposed any sort of so-called voluntary repatriation, and eventually did agree to it, largely, I think, because they were tired of war after 2 years, and more importantly, because Stalin died in March of 1953. That was really the turning point in the Korean War.
Well, Veterans Radio. Oh, by the way, folks, if you have a question for Colonel Latham or any of our guests, please give us a call at 877-573-7825. We pay the freight. We pay for that call. You know that, don't you? Right, Dale?
Yes,
we
do.
877-573-7825. We welcome your comment. With me now, my second guest is Lewis Carlson, a retired professor of history and former director of American Studies at Western Michigan University. Go Broncos. He taught courses in American history and popular culture, BA and MA from the University of Michigan, and his PhD from Michigan State University. Oh, we won't even talk about that one. Michigan State University. Lewis Carlson has also written many books on prisoners of war, one in particular, The Wind Blew Cold, The Story of American POWs in North Korea, and recently, Remembered Prisoners of a Forgotten War, An Oral History of Korean War POWs. Let's give a big welcome to Lewis Carlson. Lewis, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Nice to have you. And I understand you're in Ludington right now, which is on the western shore of Michigan. Is that right?
I am indeed. I'm looking at beautiful Lake Michigan as we speak.
Yes, yes. We got those wonderful reservoirs of fresh water. Lewis, when we talk about POWs, now, were they released right on July 27th, or was there a month delay, or were they released before? Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, there was more than one release. There was an Operation Little Switch that occurred much earlier, which is important to mention because out of that repatriation came many of the myths of collaboration. North Koreans and the Chinese selected certain prisoners who were called progressives who may or may not have cooperated. In any case, they were sent back early, and out of that came the idea that somehow our American POWs in Korea were not made out of that same stern stuff of our greatest generation of World War II, that collaboration was widespread, etc., and further accenting this view was a very important movie, unfortunately a well-made movie, The Manchurian Candidate, where we get the term brainwashing in our vocabulary, the idea that the Chinese, with their diabolical Fu Manchu-type torture, could turn our boys into silly putty because their moms, Angela Lansbury played the mom in the movie, simply were raising a bunch of sissies. All of this was nonsense, of course, but this was also the middle of the Cold War, and these men became scapegoats. In fact, that whole generation of Korean War soldiers became scapegoated. I feel very strongly about this because it's my generation. I was in high school for the first 2 years of the Korean War and in first year of college the third year. And although the tributes continue, and rightly so, to our greatest generation, you don't hear anything comparable about the men who fought and died in the Korean War.
Now, when we look back at World War II, there really wasn't anybody that left the American army or military to go stay with the Russians or stay with the Germans and in Afghan and Iraq. I don't recall to you, Dale, of any of our soldiers or what saying, I'm going to stick around here. No, we don't hear about that. So it only happened in Korea. And you touched on it so much. It was a political back and forth, a tug of war, and our boys, men. Were there many women POWs, Lewis?
Certainly not in the front lines. I think a couple nurses had been captured, but I haven't dealt with them. I don't have any statistics on nurses.
Well,
or in World War II, for that matter, except for an occasional nurse.
Now, here it is. They've been negotiating for over a year at Panmunjom. Was it Panmunjom? Pyongyang.
Yes.
Panmunjom.
Panmunjom. Okay.
Panmunjom.
They were negotiating. So there was some light at the end of the tunnel, something. Did conditions change during the last year as they got closer and closer to an agreement? Lewis, can you comment on it?
Yeah, let me preface that, however, by talking about conditions in the prisoner of war camps in North Korea, because without a firm understanding of how dismal conditions were, we can't really evaluate real or imagined behavior of the prisoners themselves. For example, that first winter of 1950, your listeners will recall that MacArthur had assured us that our boys would be home by Christmas. So we went into that fall in our summer uniforms, and when the Chinese poured in November, and the war ensued, and the first American boys were captured, they were ill-prepared for winter conditions in which temperatures plummeted to 40 below zero. One of the doctors, William Shaddish, who was captured, a POW, took care of many of the men, estimates that as many as 70% of the American men captured that first fall and winter died in captivity.
Wow. 70%.
Now, many of those numbers will appear in the MIA counts. There were over 8,000 MIAs in the Korean War, and many of those died on the marches. There were no permanent camps to put the American prisoners in. Later, they opened along the Yalu River, so they kept marching them around. And in summer uniforms, when the conditions and temperatures are plummeting, does not work very well, and very few rations. So that first winter was when the majority of the American prisoners died. To give you an idea, the official figures are 40% of the Korean-American POWs in Korea died in the camps. So conditions were atrocious. Men did not have sufficient food. They didn't have sufficient clothing. They didn't have any medicine at all initially. Now, this is all to preface what happened, because this war was as much a propaganda war as it was a shooting war. And the Chinese were insisting that, that the communist system was preferable to capitalism. And yet, when these statistics started to creep out of how many Americans were dying, and it wasn't only Americans, there were some Brits involved and Australians too, but they were going to have especially as we started negotiating a peace, they were going to have trouble convincing the world that their system was all that positive or superior to capitalism if they allowed all these men to die.
Okay.
And so because
Professor
of Trump
Carlson, we have to take a break right now. We'll be right back with you. We'll be right back. You listen to Veterans Radio. Don't go away. For the past 100 years, Amish furniture craftsmen have placed great value upon the beauty and quality of their work, with great attention paid to the details of the wood. Each board is then hand-selected to match the specific furniture in mind and in achieving the desired look of the finished piece. At Naked Furniture of Ann Arbor Showroom, you will find displays of this fine craftsmanship that you can afford and own. Now is the time. You can visit Naked Furniture at 3570 Washtenaw Avenue and experience this fine quality for yourself. The furniture consultants at Naked Furniture of Ann Arbor are there to show you the fine details of Amish furniture. See for yourself the fine quality Amish furniture. Go to Naked Furniture of Ann Arbor, 3570 Washtenaw Avenue, or visit their website, nakedfurnitureofannarbor.com.
If you would tell me I'm the only one that you love, life could be a dream, sweetheart.
Hello, hello again, shaboom, and up and we'll meet again,
oh my. Yeah, that's shaboom, the Four Aces? Did I get that? Oh, I got that right. Okay. Well, we have with us our guest today, Professor Lewis Carlson, historian and writer, and Colonel William Latham, historian and writer. Colonel Latham, before we went on our break, I wanted to review more of our Cold Days in Hell, the American POWs in Korea, that you had published earlier this year for Texas A&M. Based on what we heard from Professor Carlson, fill in a few facts and stories that you have regarding the POWs.
Well, thanks, Bob. First, I want to say that I set out to write an oral history of Korean War POWs, and then discovered that my friend and colleague Lou Carlson had already written that book, and it's a wonderful book, and it's called, and you mentioned it earlier, Remembered Prisoners of a Forgotten War. It's a marvelous book, and once I became aware of it, I had to write a different book. The book I wrote is more of a chronological history, whereas Lou's book is a straight oral history, and it's magnificently done. I would also mention Lou's books, An American Dream, about Clarence Adams, one of the 21 non-repatriates we discussed earlier, and also When Hell Froze Over, Bill Shaddish's memoir, which he wrote with Lou Carlson. That said, I think the most fascinating anecdote I came across during my research was the story of Father Emil Capon.
Ah, yes.
And I know you've had other guests. I believe you had Bill Funches.
Yes.
On as a guest back
yes.
in April, right before Father Capon was awarded or received the Medal of Honor posthumously. Of course, Father Capon was an American Army chaplain captured at the Battle of Unsan, who died in captivity in May of 1951. And Father Capon was a courageous chaplain in battle with the 8th Cavalry Regiment, and his service to his fellow soldiers became even more important after capture, when he openly defied communist efforts to indoctrinate the men. And for example, and I think the single most memorable moment of his time in captivity was the Easter sunrise service that he held for the prisoners at Camp 5 in Pyeongtaek on Easter morning, 1951, in open defiance of the communist ban on any religious services. He was a moral threat to the Chinese and their control over the prisoners. And because he posed a threat, they were more than happy to ship him off to their so-called hospital when he became sick. That was a hospital from which few men returned. Capone was taken there forcibly over the protests of his fellow prisoners, and he died there essentially of starvation and neglect. I'm sure you've mentioned to your listeners, he is being considered for sainthood by the Catholic Church.
I think he's already at the beatification tier, the status. Isn't that correct?
I hesitate to say that I think the most interesting recent development on Father Capone is the possibility that his remains may have been identified in the punch bowl in Hawaii. There's a Pentagon lab out in Hawaii that has been progressively examining the remains of Korean War MIAs who were collected at the punch bowl after the war. They were collected from Korea and reinterred at the punch bowl. And over the last several decades, of course, we've developed the technology to do DNA matching and to identify these remains. It's slow, difficult work. There is the possibility, evidently, that Father Capone's remains may be among those at the punch bowl being examined by the Pentagon's laboratory out there. So it's an interesting story. That was published in the Wichita Eagle earlier this week, and the Associated Press has also run a story on it.
Right, and I just want to do a little self-promotion here, is that we did our special program on April 6th of this year about Father Capone and the Medal of Honor. And
you can get that by going to our website.
Just go to our archives. And the other thing is that we have...
What is our website, Dale?
I think it's veteransradio.net/archives.
Mm-hmm.
And you can find out all of these older programs. We also did a program back in December of last year called Missing Dog Tags about Ken Eaton, and he tells his story of being a POW in North Korea. And the conditions that these men lived under is just... It's unbelievable that any of them survived.
Anybody could survive.
Of them survived.
Anybody. Professor Carlson, we're getting close to where we're going to have to be signing. By the way, folks, if you do have a question for either of our guests or want to comment, please give us a call, 877-573-7825. All of our operators are standing by right now, and our operator is giving us a big smile. Yes. Professor Carlson, when we talk about these POWs, they really were pawns. It was almost as if they didn't have a chance. When I look at the Manchurian Candidate, why didn't we even censor that film? Can you want to comment on that? That was a terrible, terrible slur on American military folks. You want to comment on that, Professor?
Well, again, you have to place the Korean War in the context of what was going on politically at home, and we were in the midst of the Cold War. We were in the midst of the McCarthy years, in which anybody and everybody could have his patriotism challenged. It was, I think, in my mind, the most dangerous few years in the history of this country in terms of private liberties. And there was a hysteria in the land. I mean, in my hometown of Muskegon, for example, we fired a junior high teacher because he wrote a book in which there was no money. Clearly a communist idea, you see. And so this kind of framework, and when we sent our first few prisoners back in Operation Little Switch, an Army psychologist by the name of Mayer interviewed them and asked them if they had cooperated, and some of them said they had, and said, but that was only because all prisoners cooperated. So we got that in our heads, that these men were not the same forthright and upstanding soldiers that we had in World War II. However, I did an oral history of World War II, and I interviewed an interrogator And he said, it's pretty easy to make people on either side confess to real or imagined sins, but that's beside the point. So I think it was the times more than anything else, the hysteria that was going on at home, the great fear that Stalin's promise to engulf us might indeed be true if we weren't careful, and also voices who were exploiting this fear for political reasons. And so that really made it clear. And if there's anything, I want to say what I'm going to say now, I want to say more than anything else, because I interviewed over 50 former POWs from Korea, and they are truly a forgotten generation. And they have been very bitter about their experiences. If you check the heroic exploits of our American boys in World War II or in Korea or in Vietnam, you're going to find the same general percentage of those who go far beyond the line of duty and those who do not. So it was the times that made the Korean War soldiers in general and the POWs in particular the most maligned in our history.
I want to give a couple more heads up here, folks. Get your pencils out. Remember, Prisoners of a Forgotten War, an Oral History of Korean War POWs by Professor Lewis Carlson, C-A-R-L-S-O-N, Lewis Carlson. Remember, Prisoners of a Forgotten War. That's from St. Martin's Press, 2002. There is a paperback, so you can even get it in paperback. Remember, Prisoners of a Forgotten War, and Cold Days in Hell, American POWs in Korea, by Lieutenant Colonel William Latham, but it's not that, it's William Clark Latham is the way he has it here. So, Cold Days in Hell, American POWs. I have about 1 minute before I'm going to have to say my bye-byes. I'm going to give you each about 30 seconds for final comments. Professor Carlson, you first.
Well, I'm very grateful to you, as I am to anyone who brings the experiences of the Korean War soldiers and POWs to light so with Americans people can get a more balanced view of those very heroic Americans who died and fought in Korea.
Oh, couldn't be absolutely well said. Colonel Latham?
I agree completely with what Lou said, and I would just add that we're still at war in Korea, and Korea demands our attention whether we like it or not.
How about it, Dale? Do you have any final comments?
No, I disagree with both of them. That's one of the reasons that we've been doing a lot of programs in the last year on Korea. Korean veterans, mm-hmm. and the POW issue there. And we want to point out also that the greatest generation are the people that go to war during their time. So, you know, we all do our jobs.
Well, based on that, I'd like to conclude today's program. And by the way, we'll be back again next Saturday. And our host will be
Dwight Zimmerman. A couple of authors will be on, more authors.
Korea, the Forgotten Men, the Forgotten War, they call it, in the face of good men. We'll pretend it never happened and never speak of it again. It's a time that we said thank you for what you did. Back then to say welcome home and God bless you. Then to speak again and again of the honorable men who fought that war. Never to be forgotten again. Welcome home. And for those of us here at Veterans Radio, I think I can extend that for all of us, Nina, Maria, Dale, and myself, and Veterans Radio, and all you listeners, to you Korean War guys, welcome home.